Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Bob Eubanks.
With Stephanie Edwards. Hello.
2011. It's going to be a great year, I hope.
It feels good so far.
Yeah. And we welcome you to our coverage. We do our best to make it really special for you. So I hope you enjoy it.
The West Covina Rose Float Foundation presents a tribute to first responders. It features real-life representatives, all from West Covina's police and fire department, and a trio of young friends who are heroes in the making. The kids are holding a floragraph that depicts some of the courageous firefighters who responded to the 9/11 attacks. It's finely crafted from crushed sesame seed, chip pecan, and cocoa bean shells, and dockweed. You know, I was reading the other day about the fact that faces used to be done with flower petals, but flower petals decay. So Jim Hind came up with the crushed walnuts and other ideas of using nuts to keep the faces looking good.
Boy,
I'm
look at
going
that.
To apply some nuts to my face this year.
Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. It's funny, you know, out here in Los Angeles on New Year's Day, we've got the Rose Parade, and it's hosted by Bob Eubanks and Stephanie Edwards. I never watch the Rose Parade because, I don't get it. But Katrina watches it every year. Well, the older Stephanie Edwards gets, the funnier she gets because she's provided nice little gems like that one you heard there in the intro. But this one, this was the best one. I mean, seriously, she laid a golden egg. Katrina comes to me, she goes, oh, it's a classic. And it was, so. Chef Susan Feniger is going to be calling in a few minutes to promote something really cool and something I would love for all of you to enter. It's the Wild Alaska Fish Taco Recipe Contest. It runs through January 31st. The winner will be announced on February 15th. Visit alaskafishtaco.com for all the details you need. All you do need to know is that you need to create the best fish taco using at least one species of wild Alaska seafood in your recipe. Work on every single detail. Write down the recipe to the T and submit it to their website. Chef Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken will actually make these recipes and taste them themselves. So this is the real deal. It's a real recipe contest being judged by real chefs. Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger are longtime collaborators and best friends. I know most of you know them from their Food Network show, Two Hot Tamales. But out here on the West Coast, where Southwest and Mexican cuisine basically reigns over most cuisines, they're known for their incredible food at their restaurants, Border Grill, Cuidad, and the Border Grill Truck, which I talked about last year. You might remember me recapping the Jonathan Gold food event last year, where I met Bobby Bogner's brother, Nick, who is Director of Operations at Border Grill. He told me about this petition they had to allow the Border Grill truck to operate at Los Angeles International Airport, LAX, here in Los Angeles. In addition to all of this, there is Susan Feniger's Street, which is another restaurant that she owns that offers street food from around the world, not just Mexico, food from India and other places. So Susan Feniger is she's deeply involved in the food community, and she's a Top Chef Master. You may have remembered her from Top Chef Masters last year. She went pretty deep in the competition. Back to your fish taco recipe. You're going to be judged on how good it tastes, because that, of course, is the most important part, how creative you are in making the fish taco and how easy it is to put it all together. Because let's not forget this. Good food is simple food. We say it all the time. Don't overthink anything when it comes to food. It bears repeating this. Mother Nature does all the work for you already. All you need to do is put the ingredients together, but be creative and make sure that it tastes good. The grand prize winner, and this is big, if you win this whole thing, you're going to win a round trip 3 days, 2-night trip to Santa Monica here in California, in Los Angeles. You'll have hotel accommodations at the Oceanfront Lowe's Hotel. And the best part about this whole prize, and I can't believe they're even doing this, it's a ride-along Okay, you're going to ride along and serve your winning taco recipe from the Border Grill Taco Truck with both chefs Mary Sue and Susan. All right, on top of that, you're going to have dinner at Border Grill Restaurant, and they're giving you an Olympus digital camera with HD video. Then, this really doesn't suck, a Universal Studios VIP experience. And that's not all. On top of all that, Mary Sue and Susan are going to sign a bunch of their cookbooks for you, lay a $500 Visa gift card on you for a little extra spending money while you're here in California, because you're going to need that. Now, and if you don't win whole grand prize, they're still giving away another prize, is a People's Choice First Place prize, all right? They're giving a first place prize, a free iPad, if you win that. There are recipe contests, then there's this. You guys, don't pass this up. You've got all month to get yourselves together, get a recipe submitted. I've got questions for Susan that are going to help you get a little pointers from the pros, at what they're looking for, and how you can go about actually doing this. They've got a commercial on the contest website, alaskafishtaco.com, and I'm going to play that for you before we get to the interview.
A long, long time ago, some very ancient Hawaiian surfer dudes were wanting to nosh on some tacos. So they grabbed their longboards, caught the lip of a tasty curl, thinking they were totally headed to Mexico, made one wrong turn, and bam, welcome to Alaska. It was cool. That's because the very ancient Hawaiian dude scored some totally amazing wild Alaska seafood, built a fire on the beach, whipped up some fresh tortillas, slapped them together, and schwa. New food group, dude. Fish tacos. They eventually waxed up and nose-rode a double overhead gnarly barrel due south all the way to California and introduced the fish taco there, too. But that's another story. Some 200 years later, back here is where we find Mary Sue Milliken, co-chef and co-owner of the Border Grill restaurants in L.A. and Las Vegas, and the Border Grill truck. That's because she and business partner, Chef Susan Finniger,
hi,
are throwing a massive contest called the First Ever Wild Alaska Fish Taco Recipe Contest. And since Alaska is home to the most amazingly tasty and awesomely sustainable seafood on the planet, they flipped a coin. Mary Sue won and came to Yakutat, the surfing capital of Alaska, to totally make sure the fish taco bar was set really, really high in the place where it all began.
Today we're working with this gorgeous Alaska cod. Line each tortilla with a little lettuce leaf so that the juiciness of the salsas and the fish don't make that tortilla soggy. So we have our fish on top of our tortillas and lettuce, and then we're going to just put a little guacamole, salsa fresca, and a tiny drizzle of olive oil. That is one delicious wild Alaska fish taco. Woohoo!
The grand prize winner gets a whole bunch of insanely cool stuff, topped off by, will you tell him, Miss Alaska Fish Taco, Cam?
You're invited to join Mary Sue and me for an afternoon in the Border Grill truck and help us prepare your delicious fish tacos made from all natural and sustainable wild Alaska seafood.
Woohoo!
Yum. Way tasty. Thank you, very ancient Hawaiian surfer dudes. Look what you started, bras. Enter for a chance to win the first ever Wild Alaska Fish Taco Recipe Contest at www.alaskafishtaco.com.
We're joined now by a powerhouse chef, restaurateur, Food Network alumni, and a Top Chef master. She's Chef Susan Finniger. Susan, it's an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on.
So you are challenging us to make the tastiest fish taco imaginable.
You know, I mean, everybody loves tacos. And, you know, over the last, I would say, probably 10 years, you know, and probably even less than that, maybe 5 years, I think fish tacos have just become really hot, where it used to only be carnitas and carne asada. People now, and particularly in California, but I think everywhere, are just loving the idea of fish tacos because they're typically lighter, they are healthier, they, you know, sort of add a healthy alternative to tacos, and they're just, I mean, basically, they're just good. They're fabulous.
I absolutely agree with that. How did you get involved with wild Alaska seafood?
Well, you know, I would say probably about 10, 12 years ago, Mary Sue and I were asked to do something up at Monterey Bay Aquarium, one of their events. And we were up there and went to a couple of different lectures that were put on by different marine biologists that were speaking about what we are doing to our ocean. And I think we were both blown away that, you know, without knowing it, when eating fish became sort of the thing to do maybe 15 years ago, what's happened is that there's been such a demand for fish that we have over the years started to, because it's the way our system works, we overfish, we want things when we want them. And so what's happened is that there's been many fisheries that are doing this improperly, meaning they're, you know, scraping the bottom of the ocean, and there's all this byproduct that's getting caught up in nets that then is being thrown back into the ocean or dies because we're not fishing in a way that is sustainable, meaning really helps to nurture the environment. And we overfish because there's such demand. For example, Chilean sea bass is a perfect example. Sea bass, great fish. Everyone loved it, fell in love with Chilean sea bass. We all ate it at restaurants. We pushed it. And then eventually what happened is that all the larger fish got caught. Then we started catching all the smaller fish. And then there were no fish that were growing up and having babies. And now it's almost no longer a part of our seas. And so our ocean. So what we're trying to do as restaurateurs and how we got been involved with Alaskan seafood, because we were very and still are very involved with Monterey Bay Aquarium and their Seafood Watch program. Alaskan seafood we've been working with because in Alaska, which is one of, I think, the only places in the world, but this state basically has in their constitution that protecting, that in order to fish there, the fisheries have to be sustainable. They have to be protecting the environment. And this is something that's part of their constitution because it's a huge part of their economy. So almost everything and everything that you get from Alaska, whether it's salmon or halibut or cod or black cod, which is one of my favorite fish ever, you know, Alaskan crab, these are all being fished sustainably, all protecting the environment. So rather than having to understand like where every single fish comes from, honestly, if you know you're going to your market and you're buying it from Alaska, it's sustainable. It's protecting our environment. So we were totally jazzed when we found out about this and very excited to support Alaskan seafood.
Now, is Wild Alaska seafood readily available in stores like Whole Foods and Wild Oats?
Yes, it is. It's widely available. And certainly, you know, you can find frozen Alaskan seafood, which honestly, even when it's frozen, if it's frozen properly, oftentimes it's even better than getting fresh that's been frozen typically and then thawed. And so, yes, it is available. You can get it. It may be that it's frozen, but honestly, I think what happens there is done in a really proper way. And so you're getting pretty fresh fish, even though it's frozen.
Now, I'm going to ask you two questions here. And they might be stupid questions, but that's my job, to ask stupid questions.
Okay, good.
Do you ever use non-sustainable species when you're cooking?
Could I say ever? Yes, I'm sure that I do.
But you try to avoid it.
Our restaurants, all of our chefs know and are instructed, and everybody's very, you know, everyone's really proud of it and excited. So that our rule at the restaurants are that we only buy sustainable seafood. That is it. That's what, no matter who we buy from, it's sustainable. Now, if I'm out eating and I want a piece of fish, you know, I do often, I'll ask, you know, is the fish sustainable, or I know what's sustainable, but I'm sure there are many times where I'm getting something that's not sustainable. But it's, you know, it's easier and easier to get sustainable seafood, and certainly it's something that we in our restaurants are serving, in all the restaurants, even on our Border Grill truck, we do. But at Border Grill at Mandalay Bay, Border Grill downtown, Border Grill Santa Monica, our Border Grill truck, over at Susan Feniger Street, all of the fish we serve is sustainable.
Okay, so given what you just said, and given all the things that you've said, I have another question that's probably even dumber than the first one. What is your stance on farm-raised fish?
Well, you know, let's see. I mean, typically, I think if you go to Monterey Bay Aquarium, to their website, go to seafoodwatch.org, typically what they will tell you is most farm-raised fish is not really what we want to be, you know, buying. There is some. There is some farm-raised fish. But as a rule of thumb, it's not, you know, I think there was a long time there where people thought, okay, we can get farm-raised fish. But basically, it's not necessarily the kinds, the fish that I want to be purchasing, nor do we want to be purchasing that for the restaurant.
Right, because that's a big debate here. I mean, I had this whole conversation with Bogner about how people are for the ethical treatment of animals as long as the animal is cute and fuzzy. But something like a catfish or any fish, it doesn't matter because, you know, it tastes good and it's not a cute and fuzzy animal. So I wonder if people are okay with it because it's farm-raised and we're not depleting the ocean and fish is fish.
Well, you know, it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting thing that happens, which is that in general, you know, when I think people that are aware of animals are aware because of the emotional connection.
Right.
And I think with fish, it's different. And so you're less, I think many people are less connected with fish as an emotional attachment. But I think when you begin to learn about what's happening to our ocean, then it becomes more emotional.
Absolutely.
You know, when you see what fishing practices are damaging the ocean, when you see how we're fishing, how it's depleting the fish populations and destroying all the habitats, and how some of the farm-raised, you know, the farm-raised fish that are connected to the oceans, how they're polluting the waters. And, you know, when you start to learn about that, I think then it becomes more of an emotional issue, for sure.
Right, because nobody has a pet monkfish named Frank that they cuddle with every night.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so the thing is, when people think of fish tacos, the first thing they think of are places like Rubio's or Wahoo's. What distinguishes itself as the perfect fish taco to you?
Well, I have to say, you know, I think, I mean, one of the things I learned, and this was on one of our very first trips that Mary Sue and I took when we went to, we were in Mexico, this is probably 1982, we took one of our first trips down into the Yucatan, and we were in a town called Merida, and there was a little taco stand there, and the guy was making fish, he was making all types of tacos, but on there he was making these salmon tacos, these shrimp tacos, these crab tacos. And they were little tiny homemade corn tortillas. They were a little bit thick. And he put like a lettuce leaf in there. And the reason he put the lettuce leaf is because everything that he was going to put in that taco was going to be juicy and full of flavor, but liquid. So, for example, he took this salmon, and this was like grilled salmon that he mixed with a little bit of like a mayonnaise that was seasoned probably with chilies and lime and that.
Whoa.
And then he put, you know, peas and radishes, and then he made a cabbage cucumber slaw that had naranja agria, which is basically a type of Seville orange, but we sort of made our own version of that with orange juice, lime juice, and grapefruit juice. So when you put this cabbage slaw on this fish taco, you've got all this juice on there, and then you take extra virgin olive oil and squirted it over the top. Well, suddenly, you know, if you don't have this lettuce leaf, all this juice goes right to the corn tortilla, and then all of a sudden your corn tortilla falls apart.
Man, this sounds really well thought out.
Yeah, I mean, totally. So we like, and he in our broken Spanish and his broken English, this is in 82, we learned that the key to making a great fish taco is that when you hold it up and you tilt it, juice runs off. If juice doesn't run off, it's not juicy enough.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So, I mean, I think, you know, it's when you're making a great taco, it's fish or any taco, it's really about, one, the tortilla, and is the tortilla really flavorful? You know, two, it's about everything being seasoned. Like, if it's fish tacos, if it's beer-battered fish tacos, the tacos have to be perfectly seasoned, the batter has to be perfectly seasoned. Is it spicy? Is it herb, you know, filled? Is the fish overcooked? Is the batter crispy? You know, and then, if it's rich like that, what's cutting it? So you always have to think about flavor, texture, flavor, flavor combinations, acid versus fat. Is that balance, sweet versus spicy versus savory? I mean, this is sort of a rule of thumb in general with cooking, but I think with tacos, it's two or three bites, because you don't want too big of a taco. You really want to be able to put it in your hand and eat it in two or three or four bites. So every bite has got to be filled with all these flavors. So it can't be too big so that everything's falling out of the taco. On the other hand, it's got to have enough of the filling so that you're not just getting tortilla. So it's all a balance. That's what it is in life, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. You know, we've got to have balance in our lives. We've got to make sure that we're not getting too much of, you know, any one thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, like beer.
Well, that you can never have too much of.
Oh, Susan, I like you so much. Now, are you and Chef Milliken going to personally make these recipes yourselves?
Absolutely.
Wow.
You know, absolutely. I mean, we'll probably, you know, my guess is we'll probably be able to look at some and say, okay, well, that doesn't look like it's going to do it. I don't think we need to test that. And others, we're going to say, wow, that sounds great. I mean, my goal is that we're going to get, you know, a bunch of ideas that we can actually use in our restaurants and steal some of those ideas.
See, there you go. You're a genius. Mm. That's how it works.
It's all about stealing.
So, so basically, what you're saying is, anybody out there who's trying to do or thinking of doing something really strange to their recipe, that might not be something that you're going to try. So you have to be careful. Like, I know all of you people out there are crazy about bacon. Bacon and everything. So maybe bacon wouldn't be a good idea in your fish taco.
Well, you know, not necessarily. Now, bacon could work, right?
Well, yeah, bacon goes with anything.
Because it's salty and rich, and, you know, you might do something sweet and spicy with it, so it could work. The thing for me is food, when you're coming up with a recipe, it needs to make sense. Every element of the dish needs to be there for a reason. Not because it looks pretty, don't add red peppers because you want color. It's got to make sense. Why are you adding something to this? Why are you putting that slaw on? What ties the dish together? You know, is it balanced, like I said, in every way, with texture, with acid versus richness? Those are the key things to ask yourself. And when you eat it, think about it. Is this fantastic? Is this like the most perfect thing? Does it need more acid? Does it need more salt? Does it need to be sweeter? Does it need more chili? You really have to think about food. Taste one bite, two bites, four bites. Is it the perfect dish?
You know, it's funny that you're saying this, Susan, because when I've had your food, when I've tasted your food, I've always thought that somebody really thought this recipe out, because there's so much balance, mm-hmm. and everything just kind of goes together. Like, you know, avocado. When you have avocado in something, you don't need more lushness because the avocado is already so lush.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, when we make guacamole, you know, usually we cut it with lime and salt, and so it's balanced, you know, and it's, you don't want too much because you want it to taste the richness, but you don't want too little, so it's too rich.
Susan, when you're developing new recipes, obviously, you know, you're thinking of flavor and freshness, but I wonder what your focus is in regards to if you think about where your ingredients come from or where they're grown.
Well, I think we, you know, as much as we can, and we're not there, you know, 100% in any way, but, you know, we try to do as much, we try to use, I mean, obviously our fish is sustainable. We try to use as much hormone-free products, dairy. If our dairy, it's either hormone-free or it's organic. You know, we try to use meat that's antibiotic-free. Some of it's organic, some of it's just hormone-free. So, you know, our rices and beans are organic, rice and beans. You know, but we're not 100% there by far. But we take small steps, and I would recommend that to everybody. You can't do everything at once. Take small steps towards that. You know, take small steps about being aware. It's a lot to learn and a lot to understand, but the little steps are what eventually, you know, make it all come together. So you can't be discouraged by the amount of information and the amount there is to do. You just have to take small steps at a time.
Well, Susan, I have a lot of fans or a lot of listeners who are fans of yours that would want to know whether or not you and Mary Sue would be on TV again someday.
Well, you never know. I mean, you know, I did Top Chef Masters last year, and I never thought I would do that. You know, I had no intention of ever doing it, and our staff was all just, like, pushing me and saying, you have to, you have to, you have to. So you never know. We may. I mean, we certainly do periodic things and guest visits and going on and judging, and, you know, maybe Milliken will get on Top Chef Masters, and although I'm sure she doesn't want to do it either, but... You know, it's just, I think it's very possible, very possible.
Well, you are very good at many things, but one of the things you're best at is handing me a segue, because I was going to ask you about Top Chef Masters. You were cooking among many of the country's great chefs in this year's Top Chef Masters. Obviously, being in the presence of chefs like Jonathan Waxman, Rick Moonen, and Susan Lee elevated your game. Do you find, and this is a question my wife wanted me to ask, do you find that working in that environment brought more creative juices out of you when you got back to working on the menus for your restaurants? Whoa, Katrina, tough question.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think what it, you know, what it does is it really, it throws you, typically when we work in the kitchen, even when we're doing 300 dinners on a Saturday night, Friday night, we try to plan as much as we can so that we're organized and together. With Top Chef Masters, your planning time is very limited. We're talking about, you know, literally, you get the challenge, you've got 45 minutes to grocery shop, and then you're going. You don't have that luxury. I think what that did was, it was interesting. It sort of reminded me, like, okay, you've got a lot at your fingertips from cooking for 30 years professionally, 30-plus years professionally. So it made me realize, you know, how broad my background is in terms of my training in the French kitchen, you know, spending a lot of time in India, in Turkey, in Israel, you know, with Opening Street. It really made me realize that, you know, that I have a lot of years and a lot of history of working in restaurants. So that was, you know, a great realization. Not that you don't know that, but once you're pushed to that test, you sort of see it there. And so I don't know if it helped in terms of creativity, but I think it gives you a different sort of appreciation of your career. And many of those guys I've known for a long time, and we had a great time. I mean, Jonathan I've known probably 25 years. Rick I've known probably 20 years. You know, Govan, who was on my first, very first challenge, although he went out pretty soon, was, you know, someone that worked for Mary Sue and I, you know, but it was just a great time to put your charity, like I put the Scleroderma Research Foundation, out there in the forefront. And I got many emails from people who felt like, you know, I put a name on Scleroderma Research Foundation.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, that felt great. I won a lot of money for my charity. So all the pressure and the stress that it puts you under, you know, made it worth it, because I was honoring my friend who had scleroderma and passed away. So
cool.
It made it all worth it. For sure, it pushes chefs like myself who have been doing this for many years. It's not so much that it pushes you to know that you're a good cook. I think we all feel like we're pretty good cooks, but it's the thinking on your feet and making changes really quickly and under, you know, a time pressure that, you know, you're always under pressure, but to do something in 30 minutes is very different than thinking about it and making something.
And even given that you were under that much pressure, you still made it pretty deep.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
And Chef Waxman almost seemed like he was Obi-Wan Kenobi in that kitchen.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Susan, thank you. This has been enlightening.
Thank you so much. Well, it's great to be on.
Go to AlaskaFishTaco.com, submit your recipe for the ultimate fish taco by January 31st, and get a chance to serve your taco with Chefs Feniger and Milliken on the Border Grill Taco Truck. That's AlaskaFishTaco.com. Susan, thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Restaurant critic Irene Verbila. She had gone to a new eatery called Red Medicine, but rather than serving her, the owners actually kicked her out. And not only that, they snapped her photo and they posted it online. Now, John Kessler is a chief food critic for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. As a chef, he also knows what it's like to be on the receiving end of a bad review. So the question, John, is why would a high-end restaurant, I mean, this is a high-end restaurant, why would they treat a food critic like this?
I mean, in a word, I think they just freaked. I mean, I think
this was not premeditated. You think they just freaked out?
I think so. I mean, I've read a little bit about it, but it seemed like they made her wait for 40 minutes. They knew it was her. The place was jamming. They couldn't seat everybody who wanted to come in.
Why would they, if they knew it was her, why would they make her wait for 40 minutes?
Well, the way the story went is they thought it was her, but they weren't sure, and then a customer recognized her. And so, but I think he wanted to embarrass her. I mean, I think she'd given a bad review too, or reviewed a dish poorly, one of the chef's dishes poorly before. And, you know, I just think he kind of snapped and wanted to embarrass her. So
no, the thing is, Verbila actually said that she wasn't even there to review the restaurant. She was just kind of checking it out.
Right, it had been open something like 8 or 9 days, and so she was just getting a first look, I think, which is something some critics do. They'll, you know, poke in early just to see what the vibe is like.
So The really intriguing part about the story is they took a photo of her.
I know.
And they sort of outed her. And this is a big deal because part of her sort of weaponry is her anonymity. So what does this mean for her?
I know. She's worked so hard to protect her anonymity. She's been doing the job for a long time. And, you know, honestly, it means not a whole lot because I think once you've been on the job for a couple of years, people start to recognize you anyhow. As long as she continues to, you know, play by ethical rules, you know, not announce she's coming, which I'm sure she wanted. I mean, I think she's a very, you know, honorable, good critic, and I think she's just trying to do her job, so.
So if you have a high-end restaurant, you're probably figuring out, okay, that's a food critic. But
right.
You know, explain how this rating system works, and also, and I know because I will read my hometown newspaper, The Washington Post, and I kind of joke to myself, yeah, a lot of restaurants just don't get very good ratings.
Right.
And so some of these high-end restaurants will argue, oh, you know, they're too stingy. So how does it work?
Everybody's a little different. I mean, our feeling at the AJC, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is that we have a 1 to 5 star rating, and if a restaurant gets a star, then it's a recommendation. So, you know, if a restaurant is just super-duper hit and miss, then it doesn't get a star. We might say it's fair.
How often does something get 5 stars? What's the usual, 2?
Usual is 2. 2 means that it's a good, solid neighborhood restaurant. You know, Atlanta is such a sprawling kind of city that we figure, you know, driving is everything here. So if it's worth the destination, then it's a 3-star restaurant.
So what is 5? Like the unicorn?
5 is where you can drink unicorn blood, you know, blood from a silver goblet.
Got it. With your foie gras
With your foie gras. No, 5 is really a restaurant that sets the tone, you know, for the region. That's just one of the great restaurants of America. And I think in Atlanta, there may be perhaps 2.
Okay, 2. Okay, that's not going to happen very often. How important are these reviews? Do they make or break it for these restaurants?
I mean, they help get the word out, and I think that, I mean, I've been on both sides of it. You know, I used to be a, you know, a restaurant cook and chef, and I've been reviewed, and I've been called out on some things that I didn't do right. But I think a good review can help. I think a bad review still gets people talking and brings them in the door. I mean, I think an honest critic is just somebody who's trying to say, you know, tell the people who want to go to the restaurant, go. Tell the people who should stay away from it, stay away. And if you go, try these dishes, you know?
Man, I really love this story. I do because, and I haven't made a secret of this, all right? I hate anonymity on the internet. I mean, that's what Zero Face and Zero Face Project, that's what Zero Face means. It's about why do we feel like we've got all this courage when we're faceless? The internet is a faceless place. It's been that way for years. People go by synonyms and, you know, they've got these pen names or screen names and no one shows their face. You've got the back of someone's head or even worse, they'll use an avatar. Show your face. Use your name. If you're going to be real, if you're going to put your words out there, be a real person. You know, the days of, you know, Ruth Reichel, it was a great time working for the New York Times and being a food critic. But those days are over. You can't be anonymous. A chef or a restaurant, they can't hide behind anonymity because they're putting their ass out there every night. Why should a food critic or a food blogger have that luxury? I mean, that's you being a coward. It's nothing more than that. Man up, bitch. Instead, you take pot shots at somebody who puts their ass on the line every single night. Someone who has got to suck up their ego and all their creativity whenever you don't like a dish that they make. I think it's bullshit. Anyway. I want to get to something really, you know, I wanted to get to this last time, but I didn't get a chance. There was a great article in Esquire about food revolution, Jamie Oliver's food revolution, and why it's never going to work in this country. Stephen March wrote this, and it was just so succinct, I had to share it with you. He says, Jamie Oliver cannot get over how fat Americans are. On the first season of his hit ABC show, which debuted last year, just as Michelle Obama was launching her national anti-obesity initiative, and the 9th season of NBC's Cash Cow, The Biggest Loser, was getting serious, the British celebrity chef could not believe that nearly half the adults in Huntington, West Virginia, were obese. He could not fathom how much they ate. He was outraged at the quality of the chicken that the children were eating at school, and though he literally tried to get the town's residents to eat their vegetables, the West Virginians were back to flavored milk and processed food Fridays the minute he left. Now Oliver is back for a second season and trying his luck in Los Angeles, where he'll take another shot in convincing Americans to choose mushroom pepperdell and seasoned parsnips over a burger with fries. He will fail, of course, not for the lack of effort, but because he just doesn't get the fact that excessive consumption is woven into our national DNA. Being an American means, and always has meant, eating too much, even if the likes of Jamie Oliver tell us not to. And even if, as one study predicts, it means the next generation of Americans could be the first to expect a shorter lifespan than the one before it. Oliver means well, and I admire his guts. The guy has sold 24 million cookbooks and starred in a dozen television shows in his native country. His crusade to improve school lunches in Britain was a triumph. He understood the roots of the food that they were eating. Cheap, lazy, short-sighted government administrations mired in bad practices. And against that framework, he knew what role to take. The firebrand reformer, a traditional role in Britain. With Food Revolution, he's trying to transfer that approach to the United States. But anyone who has lived in America knows that the government is not the cause of American fat. Americans are. The obesity problem is social, historical, even not political. The founding myth of the country, and its most important holiday, he's talking about Thanksgiving, is a spectacle of overeating. Expansion has always involved feasting. The story of the Western frontier is the story of driving immense herds of protein across an empty landscape toward their eventual slaughter. The industrial explosion of the mid to late 19th century that swelled the population of the country demanded huge amounts of food, and the greatest generation didn't create the most powerful country in the history of the world while on a diet. Food was their fuel, and if they decided to work hard and brought home lots of bacon, why not eat it? That's where we ran into trouble. Our eating habits were formed during times of immensely productive manual labor. If you're working 12-hour shifts at the car plant, you can eat whatever the hell you want. You can even eat the food celebrated on Guy Fieri's show, which drifts from restaurant to restaurant featuring all those delicious extravagances of the industrial age. Burgers with skirts of bubbly cheese, fried chicken and waffles with maple syrup and hot sauce. But these foodstuffs are now reminders of better times, like the boarded-up factories in Detroit. We used to be able to eat them without consequence because we used to work a lot harder. With 5.5 million manufacturing jobs lost since 2000, unemployment still above 9%, and many American workers happy to sit at their desks while underpaid immigrants and overseas workers do the heavy lifting for them, many of us are working less, and working less physically intensive labor than any time in recent history, and we've got the extra pounds to show for it. So while America's gut is a medical problem on a massive scale, it's also a clear indicator of industrial and possibly national decline. Oliver treats the epidemic of obesity in America as it should be treated, as a public health crisis, and his approach only makes our own perverse reactions to the growing emergence seem more ridiculous. The First Lady wants us all to start gardens, a loopy suggestion undertaken for a photo op, while fat people keep eating deep-fried butter at the state fair, and thin people continue to check the daily postings on thisiswhyyourfat.com. But if you're looking for a solution to the weight problem, you won't find it on Food Revolution or even The Biggest Loser. Instead, head over to CBS, where its breakout show, Undercover Boss, has fat cat CEOs busting their asses doing a hard day's work. Because only when we figure out how to put Americans back to work and how to rebuild a sagging infrastructure and stanch the flow of government jobs overseas will the pounds start melting off. I think it's dead on the money. And I'll tell you, it makes a good point. We really need to start looking deep inside ourselves and realize that maybe the government's not the problem. Maybe we're the problem. And that's all I have for you. Don't forget to enter your fish taco recipe at alaskafishtaco.com for a chance to cook and serve your taco alongside chefs Susan Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken on the Border Grill truck here in Los Angeles. Thanks to KTLA here in Los Angeles and CNN for the audio. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. We're really popular on Facebook. We've got links to all this stuff on the website, mylifeasafoodie.com. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Ciao.